There's a pretty good chance that you, as a discriminating culture vulture, probably spent some portion of this summer hearing this song, Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, play over and over from car speakers, in stores, in restaurants, or perhaps playing just underneath the other joyful sounds that people tend to make in the late dark hours of a happy Saturday night. But how aware are you of the similarities between Blurred Lines and Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up? Are you comfortable knowing that a successful and privileged white man has ripped off one of Motown's greatest innovators, and that he has, in turn, filed a preemptive lawsuit against Marvin Gaye's family so that they can't seek a claim of copyright infringement? Or is this something that you can push to the side? Is this something that you can deal with? This is, after all, mere background music. But let me ask another question. When was the last time you read a book, or listened to an album, or took in a piece of art, or watched a movie that was just outside your comfort zone? Is culture something that just plays in the background while you work? Or are you truly committed to delving into it, to living it, to understanding it? Are you interested in going out of your way to resist the hot choices dictated by mainstream media, or even some guy in Brooklyn who talks to authors for a very long time on a podcast? My name is Edward Champion, and this is The Bat Segundo Show. I'm asking these questions because the next two episodes of this program are devoted to an investigation of a uniquely American cultural epidemic. Given the limitless choice we now have with the internet, why do we tend to gravitate to the culture that everybody else likes? Or, if we're listening to mainstream culture, why don't we use our independent minds to come away with a different, idiosyncratic take? Well, we're airing two shows this week devoted to answering these questions. The first conversation, which you are about to hear, is with a young writer named Chiese Lehman. Agate Publishing sent me two books out of the blue. One was this genre-blurring novel called Long Division. I read this book in one sitting, and I really loved it. The book's vivacious and often iconoclastic spirit reminded me very much of a young Percival Everett. The other book from Chiese is a collection of essays called How to Slowly Kill Yourself in America. So I knew after reading both of these, I had to talk with him. To offer you some fair warning, I should point out that we recorded our conversation just underneath the Manhattan Bridge. I'm not sure what I was thinking exactly, because there are all these clamorous subway cars just above us, but maybe I felt that what we talked about was being pushed under the bridge too often. The second conversation, show number 514, is going to be coming later this week, and will deal with the issue of outsiders and iconoclasts and their increasing appropriation by institutional forces. I'd recommend listening to both of these programs, as the topics do cross over and mesh in interesting ways. If you would like to comment upon this program, you can email me at ed@edrants.com. To listen to this show and more than 500 others, please go to batsegundo.com, BatSegundo, and please spread the word about this show. Your helpful and enthusiastic input through iTunes reviews, social media, Tumblr posts, carrier pigeons, telegraphs, well, Morse code doesn't exist anymore. Well, this all helps to keep this show going. And now, here's Chiese Lehman.
Casey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're actually recording this under the Manhattan Bridge. This is the first time I've recorded, I think, any show under a bridge, and so you're my guinea pig. This may be the first podcast or radio of all, perhaps, recorded in this area. I don't know. So thanks for being an innovator.
Appreciate
with me.
It, man. It's my first time under a bridge.
So. Oh, okay. Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So let's start with Long Division, which is truly a tale of two cities.
Yeah.
You have this kid named City. He's in 1985. He's in 2013. There's a book called Long Division within Long Division.
Right.
And this reminded me very much of Stag R. Light's My Pathology and Percival Everett's Erasure. I'm wondering, just because we have to ask you, well, how did this get started? So to what degree were you responding, like Percival Everett, to limited literary representations of the African-American experience, and how was this a way for you to explore versions of City in 1985 that you couldn't pursue in the present day?
Right. I think that's a great question. So, you know, I think I had to make it a metafictive book particularly because I wanted the characters to consciously and unconsciously be exploring not just the lit that had come before them, but the literature that they'd read that had come before them, right? So there's literally, I call it like a mechanism in place that I'm critiquing as an author.
Yeah.
But I wanted to create two different cities who were also, you know, even though they're 14, very aware of the lit that they read, right? They don't, and very really aware of canonical lit. And so, you know, they're important scenes. There's a scene in the principal's office. There's a scene in the library where I think that these two cities, we can see them actually trying to become runaway characters. But if they're going to be runaway characters, I had to position them as characters in some way fully aware of the lit that they've read, but not fully aware of the narratives that they're running away from.
Yeah.
So the narratives that they're running away from are different than the books that they've read. And part of the book is like they're trying to figure out, what constitutes this narrative? What constitutes this narrative that they're running away from? And as a writer, you know, obviously I'm thinking about a lot of African-American, black, Southern lit, black boy, particularly. But I wanted them to be running away from, again, literature that they read.
Yeah.
Which is really important for me.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because at one point, City, he has to stay with his grandmother in Malahatchie,
yep.
Mississippi. His reading library there is largely this kind of throwaway culture.
Right.
Centered around classic books.
Absolutely.
Capital C.
Yeah.
And the Bible.
Right.
As you write, I didn't hate on spinach, fake sunsets, and white dudes named Spencer, but you could just tell whoever wrote the sentences in those books never imagined that they'd be read by Grandma, Uncle Rel, Lavender Peeler, his friend of me,
right.
My cousin, or anyone I'd ever meet. So
right.
This leads me to ask, I mean, why do you think in the South, or these for these characters especially, that their notion of what it is to be alive is so rooted around books? And, you know, to what extent, you know, were you limited in these areas, you and City? I mean, why is that such an important definition?
Well, you know, a lot of people have called Mississippi, particularly in the South, generally yeah. like the home of American storytelling.
Sure.
Going way back to Twain and whatnot. And so storytelling and story listening are part and parcel of our culture. And particularly if you grew up in a really religious gospel kind of house that I grew up in, like stories, whether they were stories that were carried through music or language or stories you had to read in the Bible, you know, stories that my grandmother told me when she came home from work, stories just carried today. So I wanted to create two characters again that were hyper aware of stories, of storytelling, and really critical of storytelling. So, I mean, you know, the book starts with City critiquing Lavander's storytelling ability and Lavander critiquing City's storytelling ability. So when they get to, by the time City gets to that library, you know, what he's trying to say is like, I'm not being completely reactionary. Like I get that there's some great sentences in these books, but I don't know what to do with the fact that these people never imagined anyone like me.
Yeah.
Reading these texts. And so for him, at this point, he really believes that audiences are like the bedrock of sentence creation, right?
Yeah.
Like who are you writing sentences to? To whom are you writing sentences? And so when he gets in that library, and it is throwaway culture in a way, you know, I mean, there's so much happens in there. He sees himself for the first time on the internet, right? He sees the way that he's presented to other people. And I just wanted to create, again, like characters who were not like too precocious, too smart, too witty, but in some way wholly aware that stories carry everything.
So what they read is almost kind of almost an alternative identity that
yeah.
I guess the United States as a whole can't actually accommodate because of the many interesting questions of race that are in this
Absolutely.
Book.
Absolutely. Huh. And this is where literature is particularly important because,
yeah.
you know, the references to hip-hop early on, and hip-hop has been critiqued, I've critiqued it, we'll continue to critique it, but one of the things that hip-hop did, I think, early on for young black particularly boys is that like it was an art form that was made popular that was talking directly to you as a 14, 15, 16, 17 year old. At least you thought that. And you know, when you get geographically specific, you start to see that a lot of these rappers from New York weren't talking to Mississippi black boys,
yeah.
but you felt that you were being talked to anyway. So one of the things that these characters are really trying to deal with is like what happens if they're, you know, what happens to the characterization of a real person and a character who is so often not written to people who look just like him, you know, them, and what they and as we see early on in the book, you know, like we get this narrative imposed on them, and they're trying to break out, and Lavander kind of sort of does break out, but there's a price to pay for for that breakage. But it's all about narrative creation.
Yes.
That's what I'm going.
I'm glad you brought up hip-hop, because I wanted to actually talk about Hip-Hop Stole My Southern Black Boy.
Okay,
one
okay.
of the essays in there, yeah. you point to, again, to how black Southerners are the generators and the architects of American music, yeah. narrative, language, capital, and mortality. You point out that the South not only has something to say to New York, but that it has something to say to the world. And I'm wondering why you think the world is so unwilling to listen. How much of this resistance to Southern innovation has to do with people who remain too caught up in some of these b-boy routines and all that?
I think the world is listening,
yeah.
but I don't think the world knows what they're listening to.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I think the world, there's no doubt the world is listening to really rock, R&B, and I would even argue funk that has its root in the Deep South. The world is listening to gospel music. The world is listening to blues right now,
yeah.
you know, that has its root. In not just Mississippi, but in like that deep Southern, South Central culture. And again, they're listening. They're dancing to it. They're making love to it. They're talking to it. It's the music that, scores our movies. But I don't really think we know. And I'm not trying to say I fully know, but I don't think we've taken enough time to think about from where that music actually comes. Like what people
yeah.
created, originated, innovated that music and why. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
so for me, I think they're listening. They have
yeah.
to listen because it's everywhere.
Well,
but they don't know
what to listen
to. The
question is, are they actively listening? I mean,
well,
I think what
listening.
You're suggesting is that it's kind of music that plays in the background
right.
without people actually comprehending that there's a lot of years and blood and sweat and tears that's put into that music.
No question.
And people are just not really curious enough to investigate that. I mean, I'm wondering if that's a larger societal problem or I think it is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is what I'm saying. Like, I don't think we take the time to question the ingredients in our art generally, right?
Sure,
like,
sure.
I haven't been in many parts of the world, but as Americans, I know we don't take the time to really consider what we're consuming, and we definitely don't take the time to consider the lives of the people who created the music. So even if we think about hip-hop, you know, if you talk, people who think they love hip-hop have no idea who Kool Herc is. People who think they love hip-hop have no idea who the people who actually helped create the culture actually were, what they did, and why they did it. So it's not specific to black American / Mississippi culture.
Yeah.
But I do think there's particular stories that come out of Mississippi culture. And again, it's just ironic that the blues, rock, gospel all come out of this really
yeah.
small part of our country. And I just think...
I agree, but I'm wondering who to impugn here. You know what I mean?
I think we impugn everyone.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, that's a loose answer, but I mean, there are people, I was just in Mississippi for 9 to 10 days giving readings and stuff. There are people in Greenville, Mississippi.
Yeah.
Black people who have no clue what the blues is.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
And what I'm trying to say is I don't know what it is, but it is an exploration that I, because of my parents, because of my grandparents, have had to go on. I'm just saying, like, we don't even want to go down that road. Because when you go down that road, you don't just find sound. Like, as you said, you find experience. You find, and you find complicity.
And if you listen very closely to the lyrics, you
yeah.
have all these amazing stories there that
right.
you, multiple times, some cadence that you
And
yeah.
what's so important about the lyrics is that I think it's really important to transcribe to see the lyrics on the page, but what's important is that those lyrics are being spat or sung or in some instances even before hip hop, like rapped, like right, like this kind of like rhythmic, I think hip hop esque kind of way of approaching music, I think predates what we call hip hop. I know New York people hate for me to say that, but what I'm saying is that it's not just about the lyrics; it's how the lyrics are said and what irony has to do with the way those lyrics are being spat. And I think
yeah.
it has so much to do with community. In this book, these particularly Long Division, is among other things, are really about like community storytelling. And so what I'm trying to say is, like, I really think we need to think about the communities, the people, the stories, and the communities that are at the heart of all the music we listen to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree with you, Kesey, but I'm wondering what is the acceptable level of cultural engagement that would actually allow the South to be understood, to be properly respected, versus the reality of people wanting to have something in the background. I mean, you
yeah.
know, is it reasonable to expect people to have that level of engagement? Much as I would also love to see that, you know.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not reasonable to expect.
Yeah.
It's reasonable to encourage, and it's reasonable to ask people to think more about from whence the music they listen to comes. Like, where does it come from? I mean, but like, no, the expectation that people are going to do that, no.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, you know, when I tell people I'm from Mississippi, nobody ever says, oh my God, you know, like the home of blues, the home of rock, like the home of sorrow songs, the home of all of this. They're like, oh, Mississippi Burning, the Klan, shit like that. Yeah. You know, that's easy.
Yeah.
And so, as a Mississippian, and I think a lot of
you're constantly having to say, hey, we've got a rich musical history here too.
And, what I like to say is not only do we just have a rich history that you should visit, I like to say you have visited it. Like, it is the soundtrack to part of your life. Now think about why you don't give a
F. You can swear on this program.
Okay, yeah. So then I'm just like, why, think about why you don't give a fuck that it has been the soundtrack to parts of your life, because I can guarantee you music that has rooted in Mississippi culture and community is the soundtrack to everybody who's listening to this today. There's no question. So then the question must be, why don't you care? And if you go down that road and you try to find the roots of that in Mississippi, in black communities, in black storytelling, in the creation of irony to survive, what else do you find? And I just think if we do that, we're going to find a lot. And I think if we value from which these things, I mean, the irony is that, like, we're not valuing Mississippi generally. We don't really value black communities in Mississippi. And these are the poorest communities in the country. So it has to go hand in hand. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, the lack of resources, the poorest state in the country, the most formerly uneducated state in the country, the state that consistently ranks at the bottom of everything, is also the state that I think gives you a lot of the soundtrack to your life.
Yeah.
And that seems not, I mean...
It's not just the soundtrack of your life. There are all sorts of influences in regular human behavior that likely come from Mississippi.
That's what I talk about, too. Yeah, right. Yeah. The language and the morality, I think, is a whole different...
I mean, do you think that cultural awareness is going to lead to a greater regional awareness in terms of people, in terms of how people live? I mean, even things involving food or whatever? I mean, you know, do you think that there's any kind of crossover? Is culture sort of the gateway drug to, I guess, understanding Southern culture, all culture? I mean, does it come from culture first, do you think?
I mean, you know, I wish I had an answer to that, man. Because when you said that, I'm thinking, is there an example throughout history of people in a nation appreciating a culture, a community, a people enough to change public policy? I don't know.
Or people's cultural engagement is related very much to wanting to visit the place and have some sort of tourist idea of what it is, such as what's happening to Albuquerque because of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Right. That's a great example.
Yeah.
But then it flips, right? Well, when The Sopranos is really successful, I heard from a lot of people in Northern Jersey that they didn't like the representation, you know?
But even though Jersey has a long history of serial killers
and
crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But to this day, you know, when I go through Jersey, I'm thinking Tony Soprano. But, you know, I appreciate that show. I mean, I appreciate it. So I don't know.
What I think I may be suggesting here and trying to get you to comment upon is that, you know, engagement with a region is often off of the cultural map altogether.
Of
and
course.
So I'm trying to determine, at least from your point of view, to what degree culture is a help or an impediment to understanding another part of our country or another part of the world.
I mean, critical engagement with the culture is a help. Blind engagement with the culture is a hindrance, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that we blindly engage with the South because I think that the South reflects a lot of who a lot of the nation runs away from. And so, like, that blind engagement with the cultural creation of the South, I think is obviously, like, it is destructive. But I don't know how you change it if you can't get into these school systems, and I don't know how you change it. But what's ironic is a lot of the music coming out of the South particularly black communities in Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, definitely Louisiana, have been all about, like, big up in the culture. Look at us. Look at what we create. You know, we're more than this. We're more than this. We're more than that. But again, it goes back to what you said earlier about music in general. Like, a lot of times we don't want to hear what people are literally saying to us, you know?
Or maybe it's what we're talking about is how culture can encourage people to be aware of the other ways in which people live. Because it's really about living. That's the only way to really understand anything, I think.
It is about living.
Yeah.
It's about living and it's about dying, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the thing about Mississippi music in general. I mean, there's a relentless obsessive desire to live, and I think if you look historically at our music, there's also this relentless obsessive desire to interrogate death, right? Whether it's like whether it's Bessie Smith and Floods or like Big Crit now, or like even these books, like, they're obsessed with versions of death. But I think that's part of our tradition.
Sure.
That's actually part of our Southern Black Mississippi tradition, and it's definitely also part of the gospel tradition, which we definitely run away from in this country for a lot of reasons.
Maybe a way of segueing this and going back to Long Division is to ask you about sort of the moral compass of Long Division. I mean, to me, it reminded me obviously very much of Octavia Butler's Kindred.
Right.
But I'm wondering if you feel like a time travel story needs to have sort of a moral equilibrium of some sorts in order to balance it. I mean, you know, was maybe I'm wondering if this was part of the appeal of the time travel plot of the fragmented timeline here, so to speak.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of appeals to the time travel. You know, as a voracious writer and reader, I'm sure you understand that there are a lot of people who believe that writing and reading are portals of time, right? Like, you can travel through time literally by reading and writing. And in one way, I wanted to make it explicit, right? Like, and so in the revisions of the book, we had to take out, like, you know, the apparatus from which these kids were actually using, you know, because it was a little bit more science fiction-y in the beginning. And then I heard from people after I took this shit out that, like, oh, you're not really being, you're not wedding yourself enough to the tradition of time travel books, science fiction books, by not making the time travel apparatus as explicit. But at that point, I already had bought into, like, the idea of, like, a meta-narrative, meta-fictive time travel thing. And these kids are, you know, they're traveling through time partially to exist, right? To find out from whence they come and where they're going. And also, I really want to question this whole idea. And you see this in Kindred a little bit, of, like, older people necessarily having wisdom, having understanding, right? Like, so whenever you have to learn from the past, but, like, you know, the last scene in the book, next to the last scene in the book, we see a grandmother who's lived through all of it. Yeah. She's lived through the 60s. She's lived through the 70s. She's lived through parts of the 50s. And she doesn't get it.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't, like, this is someone who, in some ways, has embodied more time than anybody else in that book, and she doesn't, she makes the wrong decision.
So you were really trying to make a point about how, no matter what time you inhabit, memory is ultimately, that's what's going to get the most damaged here. That's what's going to actually be the ultimate indicator of how your awareness, basically.
Well, yeah. Particularly when you live in a crazy-making nation that doesn't want to admit or accept how crazy-making it is. I mean, even, we know this, right? But we don't read enough, I think, narratives that make us understand that even older people who have lived through everything and sometimes helped make our country better, like, in particular ways, are crazy, do crazy things. Like, I just think that that's like a hard thing to accept. And it's hard to accept in this book because...
This explains Grandma. This.
Exactly. And it's hard to...
She's just constantly whooping his ass.
She's whooping him because she's partially trying to... She's partially trying to protect him.
I haven't seen a more pugilistic family member in a long while.
But you know what's important... what's important about the beating, though, in that is that... Right after the beating, like, they lie down together, right? Like, and he talks about, I mean, it's really like a sexual scene without him actually knowing that that's what he would call it. You know, he's in love with her. He likes the way he makes her feel when she talks to him, when she sees him naked. All of the things that you might attribute to, like, a romantic relationship, we see this in the, and, you know, part of it's because he's 14 and he's feeling all these things and he doesn't know what the fuck he's feeling. One of the things he starts to say at the end, he's like, "Grandma, you know, like, I love you. And if you weren't my grandma, I'd really want to be with you, you know?" But all I have to say, what I'm trying to say is that one of the reasons he wants to be with her is because he doesn't want to admit it, but he can see that she's not just a grandma. And that's, so the scene where she's grabbing her boyfriend's butt, it's like this, you know, it hurts him. It hurts him not because she's cheating on him, but because he's like, you know, fuck, she's not just a grandma. She is a complicated woman, right? And so, like, if I see her differently, that means I have to see myself differently. And I think that just goes back to what we were saying about earlier about the South, right? If you see things differently, you see people differently, like, you have to necessarily, if you value their eyes, you have to necessarily see yourself a bit differently. And I think that's what we don't want to do.
Well, this reminds me of the sentiment you expressed in the title essay for this book. It describes not only your experience with guns, how you were outed by a college president as a controversial writer who consistently editorializes on race issues, your suspension for failing to check out a book.
Right.
I mean, you write, "My saying yes to life meant accepting the beauty of growing up black on parole, surrounded by a family of weird women warriors in Mississippi," like the grandma here, the fictitious one.
Right.
"It also means accepting that George Hartman, parts of Millsaps College, the college that you had problems with, parts of my state, much of my country, my heart, and mostly my own reflection had beaten the dog shit out of me." So, you know, this leads me to wonder, are you any closer to comprehending this duality of existence? How does this act of committing everything to memory guide you in living and in writing and in understanding along the lines of what we're talking about
here?
Well,
that's a great question, man. I think the act of committing to memory for me necessitates writing. And, I'm a teacher. The act of teaching and learning necessitates writing. And so, you know, there have been times in my life when I, months in my life when I haven't written. And it just happened to be the months in my life where I made the worst decision. So when I wasn't writing, I can't say that I wasn't remembering. I was remembering, but I wasn't reckoning with those memories because I'm not a good enough person to reckon with memories, remember memories with any sort of detail without writing. Some people can do it. Some people can do it through orality. Some people can just do it silently. I'm not. I have to write it down. And so beyond anything else, I know I'm a better person after writing this book, after reckoning with those memories than I was before. And like, we can talk about all the other kind of stuff, but like, that to me was one of the things that I wanted to do. I mean, I wanted to talk to people. I wanted to encourage people to kind of find something of value in their experience and my experience. But more than that, I wanted to become a better person, because when I started this shit, I was like, I was just making bad decision after bad decision. And I didn't want to reckon with a lot of those memories. And I didn't want to reckon with my complicity in a lot of those memories. And so, like, the idea of innocence is something that I think we all want to hold on to. Everybody wants to hold on to it. And for me, I just had to, like, really start digging into these memories and realizing, I'm not innocent.
I think what you're talking about here, I mean, to me, this essay is very much a statement of you as a writer in the sense that you say, hey, my early writing was controversial, was also quashed. I mean, I was basically, outed as a writer.
Right.
But now, as I'm taking you through this essay, I am telling you that, I am humble enough to know the flaws of this and to know
Absolutely.
The pain of this and
Absolutely.
To know... that it's actually not going to get easier, contrary to popular belief, which is the thing that they never tell you as writers. It actually gets harder.
It definitely gets. And when you're 18, 17, 19 years old, man, you're kind of a lunatic. I don't care who you. I mean, you're just a lunatic.
Yeah.
And I was a lunatic in a way. But writing, I mean, I wasn't at all a good writer, but what I was decent at was critiquing the world around me, like the culture around
observing,
right? And making those observations using satire at the time to critique what I observed. But what I wasn't good at, and this is what I'm trying to say, I'm so glad you get this, I wasn't good at all about implicating myself in these critiques. So I could critique...
Well, Teju Cole, we are the heroes of our own story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And so I could critique this new... college that I went to. I'd never been surrounded 1 year, but other than that 1 year in junior high, I'd never been at a mostly white school with white kids who had money in the South. Like, that's just new to me. And so I was critiquing myself, but in writing I just wasn't courageous enough yet to talk about the ways that my failure was also part and parcel of all of this, like, frat culture and this overt classed and sexist shit that was going on around me. And so in this book, in that essay, among other things, I'm trying to be like, I was a kid though, you can't punish me for fucking writing an essay that you didn't like. And that's what I got kicked out of school for. Ultimately it was like, take a book out the library, took the shit back without checking it out. Nobody gets kicked out of school for that.
Yeah.
And I got into it with the fraternity members, but
especially when you had an accomplished kleptomaniac career before that.
Well, as a lot of people did. Yeah, I mean, we were stealing all kind of shit from school. And, my roommate, I started writing a piece about him, and I was like, no, I'm not going to. But my roommate was, he did every kind of drug imaginable.
Yeah.
And as a lot of kids were, but... I mean, every kind of drug, but he got to stay in school. So what I'm saying is, like, I understand now that I wasn't doing what I should have been doing. I shouldn't have been stealing. I should have been implicating myself more. But these are things that children don't do. So the question is, and why is this particular kind of child being told, you can't stay here? We don't think you are suitable to be educated anymore. And what I'm saying in this new piece is in that essay is that, that's wrong, it's hurtful, it's dangerous, and it's also wrong, hurtful, and dangerous for the writer, for me, not to really implicate myself, not to question myself. It's not just about George Harmon. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, George Harmon was, he made terrible decisions, man. But I did too. But, like, I was a kid. So, you got to let me be a kid. So in another essay in this book, I talk about how, you got to let, and we got to think about why we don't allow black children to have second chances.
Sure.
You know, why black kids particularly are punished so much harder for doing shit that, like, kids do all the time. I teach at Vassar College. A lot of white kids go there. A lot of drugs. A lot of sexual assault. No one has gone to jail or prison, of course, for drugs, sexual assault at all of the kids who go to Vassar College. I think you could say the same if you looked at Bard, if you looked at Barnard, if you looked at, like, that's weird. When you look at the communities right next to them, you have throngs of kids going to jail and sometimes prison for making bad decisions with mind-altering substances. That shit is just wrong.
Yeah.
It's just wrong.
Going back to this question of implicating yourself, there is one pivotal quality of this that you're leaving out that is actually very much in Long Division, and that is time.
Yeah.
I mean, it is easier to implicate yourself when enough time has passed, but
right.
Can you implicate yourself right now in the present? That's what I'm wondering. Is it getting
yes.
easier to? Or, I mean, are you getting, not easier, but are you becoming braver enough to do so?
I mean, I'm braver. I'm braver now than I was a few years ago. I mean, there's no question about it. I'm making better decisions, but I don't even know about the present. Like, one of the things I'm trying, I don't, you know, if you've read a lot, man, you know, like, I don't know that we ever are in the present.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I think the future is always speculative, but, like, I think that, you know, what we just said a minute ago is the past.
Yeah.
So I can just say I'm better at making decisions. I'm better at seeing the ways I am wrong. And more importantly, I'm better at admitting that I'm probably going to be wrong for a while longer. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I guess what I'm asking is how this relates to your own identity. I mean,
since
you're talking about, you know, who you are as a writer, and that involves implicating yourself because that allows you to come closer to certain personal truths that are, in fact, societal in some
right.
sense, you know, maybe the past is a crutch, even with this distinction you're talking about how, you know, the future is our immediate past, basically.
Well, but this is the thing about, I think, what we talk about a lot in my classes, this idea of, like, active regret, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Often you ask men, particularly, like, if they regret anything, and, you know, most manly, he man, like, I don't regret anything. You know, if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't be the person I am. As if the person you are is caring, complicated, like, the best you can be. And, like, none of us are the best we can be. Like, if we could go back and change something, I would hope every person on earth would be like, I would go back and change. And not just so we could be better people. I think I wish we would go back and change because we've hurt people. Everybody has hurt someone. So when you, like, I don't want to change, what you're saying is I don't give a fuck about that person I hurt, much less yourself. And what I'm saying is, if active regret means if I know that I'm making decisions that are hurting my nation, hurting my state, hurting myself, and hurting my people, and I'm saying actively, I'm going to be in the moment when I'm confronted with these decisions again, I think it's harder to make bad decisions. But we do make them, and I do make them.
You know, it seems to me that this idea of individual regret tied into a larger societal regret, how this has an impact upon our place and the consequences this has on, for example, race perceptions
yeah.
or, you know, anything else. I mean, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, well, Is it our duty to become so familiar with culture so that we understand its origin? Is there something similar that we can actually draw upon in terms of individual to society with things with emotions such as regrets or this issue of we are the sum of our past collections or we hurt people or something like that? Or?
Yeah, man, but it doesn't sell tickets. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the problem is. The problem is reckoning with the
message.
Well,
we're not talking about tickets. We're just talking philosophy.
I know,
right now.
But we're talking philosophy. But what I'm saying is the problem is that we're all ticket buyers, right?
Yeah.
We all buy into the pep rally. Yesterday was this big pep rally about the 50th
yes.
anniversary of the March on Washington. And President Obama and all these other speakers went up there and talked. And one of the things that you have to appreciate about a lot of those speakers is that they are putting the work in. But one of the things you don't have to appreciate is the fact that, like, almost all of them, including Obama, are sanitizing it, right? We are not a great nation. We are not solely a great nation. And, we are not the land of the free, home of the brave. We just aren't.
Yeah.
We're the land of the free, home of the brave, home of the deceptive, home of the people with lack of courage. And so what I'm saying is, like, these sentences matter. We buy into this. We buy tickets to this pep rally over and over again. And we hold pep rallies for ourselves, right? Like, we deliver ourselves because, like, this fuck, it's hard to not, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like depression and sadness is real. But what I'm saying is that we can be better, but I think we have to be led there with our art and sadly, with our political states people. But they, you know, this is where I think politics and actual, like, narrative and philosophy actually tie in. Like, but Obama, for a lot of reasons, cannot tell the truth.
Yeah.
Presidents of our nation cannot tell the truth. And that has little to do with Obama and everything to do with us, I think.
Yeah.
Like, why don't we want to hear the truth? What is the truth? And so what I'm saying is, like, our nation isn't modeling a kind of reckoning. And individually in our own lives, at least the people I know and myself, we're not performing a particular kind of reckoning. So what do we do? And what I'm yeah, and what do we do? And yeah.
Well, no, this is exactly what you touch upon in the Obama essay, where you write, "Thank you for putting the country on your back and taking up the national slack. But the truth is that our unethical, morally suspect nation doesn't deserve an ethical or moral president."
No.
And that takes us back to, like, right, you know, the Jefferson idea that Americans can get the nation that they deserve.
Right.
They deserve. That's that shit no one admits. Right. So here's my question to you. If Obama or anyone cannot be the president that black and brown folks still need, as you say, is there any office or place that can provide some ethical or moral stature? I mean, is it going to take a bunch of Harold Washingtons or Cory Bookers to actually solve this problem? Is there anything on the local level where you can actually get that satisfaction?
Everything.
Or do we look outside government? What do we do?
Well,
here?
I think you do all of that. I mean, I think you hope for politicians that have a little bit. I think you hope for politicians that are committed to doing the least amount of evil possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, personally, on the local level, that's where all the work has always really been done. It's always been done on the local level, man. I mean, we need the nation, we need Senate and Congress to be a lot less fucked up as they are, but, like, the local shit is always where the most important work is done in the community, but also on the individual level. And it might start by admitting that, like, we don't want to do right. You know what I'm saying? And there's this essay in the essay book where I talk about the worst of white folks.
Yeah.
And then I talk about the fact that my cousin, who just got out of prison, like, I know he needed to come to Poughkeepsie and just chill for, like, however long, just, you know, breathe in a different kind of air. But, like, I didn't want to risk whatever it would take to risk to get him there. Yeah. And I'm not saying that everybody has the same sort of equation. But what I'm seeing is, like, what we see now is the nation is trying to convince itself and us that we are good people. The states are trying to convince itself and us that we are good people. The communities, in some way, aren't trying to convince, because there's no, who are they convincing? The communities is where all of this fucking work is being done. And, like, we just, and this is what we see. I mean, this is what I'm saying about yesterday in March of Washington. We have all of these community leaders and activists from all around the country who are talking about some of the work that they're doing and talking about how, like, you know, the work from people 50 years ago inspired that work. That is wonderful. That is absolutely brilliant. That is really all that's going to sustain us. But we still got to do more.
Yeah.
But I don't have much hope.
We have to go back decades ago in order to actually get inspiration for the present. I mean, any kind of ideological progress has to be rooted in something that's almost nostalgic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you're right. And
we have to go back to Stokely. We have to go back to the Black Panthers. Is that really what we have to do?
But even if you go back there, man, like, you got to go back and look at the critics of those people, right?
Yeah.
Because that shit was not pure. Stokely was, a lot of those movements were, like, led by, like, you know, hyper-masculinist men who were egomaniacal.
Yeah.
That's just the truth.
Yeah.
Most movements are led by egomaniacal men who are sexist, misogynist, egomaniacal. But what other good work do they do? And that's what history teaches us. But what we want to do when we want to be nostalgic is, like, you know, hoist people up onto these fucking weird-ass pedestals that we can't touch and that we never... And, you know, if we hoist Martin Luther King up the way we have, the fucked up thing is that we know we're never gonna get close to the kind of human being he was, because we've hoisted him up to these fucking astronauts. You know, like...
Did you see that Google Doodle the other day?
No.
Where they had a Google Doodle of Martin Luther King, and it was such a slipshod, by the numbers kind of Google Doodle graphic. You would think they would get the sort of elaborate, more ascendant kind of Google graphic,
right,
and all that, and all the animation. But no, it was just your token bullshit Google Doodle, like, oh, well, I have to go ahead and do this, but I'm not actually thinking about what this means. I'm not actually thinking about, like, you know, that this was a tremendous sea change here. And this is, I think, part of the worst of white folks that you're talking about.
Right.
This idea of not sharing. I mean, how do we combat this in 2013? What's the lingering aspect of this?
Okay, I have two answers.
Sure.
One is that, you know, I just took it back to long division. The last sentence in this book, and it doesn't end with any sort of punctuation or period, is the sentences were always there. The thing about Martin Luther King is that the sentences are literally there. Like, we can see what he actually believed at different points in his life. We can see that a few years after the March on Washington, after the I Have a Dream speech, he literally said, I'm not as I'm much more pessimistic than I was, because everything that we've gotten without the nation having to risk anything, which means we really haven't gotten much. He said it. Like, the sentences are there. So what I'm trying to say is that, like, we have to ask ourselves as a nation why we don't want to look at those sentences, right? Why do we want to, why does McDonald's, Fox News, everybody and their mother want to hoist up I Have a Dream, but not hoist up the nation has not given up anything to get what it got? Like, that's a more important statement. You know what I'm saying? And so on one hand, I just think we have to be willing to go back and actually interrogate the sentences of these mythological people that we hoist up and really create. But on the other hand, man, I just don't know if it's going to, I mean, this is where I'm getting, I don't know that it's going to get better, dude. Like,
well, talking about this is a start, I would say.
Talking about it and writing about it and working.
Maybe this is what we're talking about when we're talking about cultural awareness and all that, you know, that getting people to understand what's underneath the seams. I mean, people right now are so, they want to dissect pop culture like no tomorrow.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yet it's very much like, again, it's a white thing. It's
right,
NPR
right.
Pop Culture Happy
right,
Hour.
Right,
it's
right.
Like the Slate Pop Culture Gab Fest. They very rarely get outside their sort of comfort zone. I mean, what can we do to get these people finally saying, you know, hey, look, there's all this other culture going on? I mean, you know.
But you have to interrogate the connections to popular culture and other culture, right? Like, this is, I don't think we need to not interrogate popular culture, but again, I don't know that we are really interrogating. And when we are interrogating, we're not interrogating our complicity.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're not interrogating, like, what we have to, like, Miley Cyrus is Miley Cyrus partially because of something in us, right? And so it's much easier to talk about, oh, she's twerking. And it's much easier to see her as a product of, like, I think, massive appropriation. And I think that's hard, but it's much easier to do that.
And people avoid the teddy bears.
I mean, for American,
my
right,
mind,
right,
it's
right,
the
right.
teddy bears that's the real tell here,
right,
the
right,
sort
right.
of childish idea of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm trying to say is, like, if you look at what happened at those MTV Music Awards, man, the grossest thing was the fact that we all obsessed over Miley Cyrus. And this was MTV Music Awards, where I don't know if a black person won one award.
Yeah.
And
taking over Brooklyn, by the way,
which is taking
over a great neighborhood and, like, basically,
absolutely.
I mean,
so,
yeah.
So what we see is, like, the gentrification of a neighborhood, the gentrification of an award show, the appropriation of particular kinds of music. But I'm saying beyond that, like, what the fuck does that shit really mean for, like, how we live our lives? Like, what does that mean? What does it mean? And what I'm saying, and instead of asking that question, and I'm super guilty of it, what I want to do is talk about the politics of Miley twerking. But again, like, nobody wants to talk about, like, you know, Robin Thicke coming up there literally looking in that tight ass shit looking like Elvis. You know, people don't want to talk about Justin Timberlake winning the Michael Jackson Award. So we don't want to talk about a lot of this shit that would implicate us more.
Yeah.
If we like him, we like him.
Yeah.
If we don't like him, we don't like him. And so, you know, so all that to say, I don't think we need to run away from pop culture.
This is actually a very good segue into your eulogy for Three Black Boys Who Lived, in which you write about Michael Jackson, whose mortal sacrifice is also incidentally referenced in Long Division, Bernie Mac, and Tupac. You write, for example, of Tupac that you couldn't imagine him living over 25 in our United States. So my question to you maybe is a way of jumping off of this issue of twerking and all that and the politics of Miley Cyrus is, well, you know, what is the common ground in the way that these men were eaten alive by America? Do you have any ideas on how to prevent this from happening for future cultural figures?
Oh, that's a good question, man. I mean, you know, like, the same thing didn't take out all three of those guys, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think you can see some similarities in Michael Jackson's demise, death. Some people call it murder, but I'll just say death, and Tupac's murder, right?
Yeah.
Like, celebrity, a particular kind of recklessness that became spectacle. I think you can look at that in both of those situations. Bernie Mac, there wasn't that. He wasn't that kind of performer. He wasn't that kind of person. You know, it was natural. It was, you know, he just died. It didn't have anything to do with that. But if we're gonna talk about Michael Jackson and Tupac, I think everything that we've been talking about is part and parcel of why they're dead, right? I don't know how you can become the king of pop, meaning like millions and millions of eyes are on you as a black American subject and be healthy.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure somebody smarter can show me, and people can be like, oh, this person did it, but I don't know how you can do it. I don't know how you can, like, have millions and millions of eyes of uncritical people watching you, needing you to do shit, and be healthy. And for Michael Jackson, we see it. I mean, you just, like, his face, his body is a testament to how fucked up we are.
Yeah.
And we can talk about how fucked up he is.
Yeah.
But everybody, and we
but he offers a perfect place to project things that we don't want to talk about.
And he did it. I mean, this is the thing. Like, Michael Jackson showed us, dude. He showed us, like, who we are, where we are.
Yeah.
Man, I want it. And Tupac showed us, too. And so that's what I'm trying to say in that piece. My friends, at least, down south, we knew Tupac was about to die. Like, there wasn't any question. A lot of 25-year-old black men that we knew killed and or were killed. So this guy who was constantly getting shot and shot at was eventually going to die, right? And the sad thing is, like, I think he was smart. I mean, he was so fucking smart, dude. He was so brilliant. But
he lives on in Coachella holograms.
Right. That's right. He lives on.
I mean, we want to actually turn them into ghosts now. Digital ghosts.
Right.
Finally.
But we want that to live on. You know, that's what I'm saying. We want that Tupac to live on, you know, doing Hail Mary or something like that. But we don't want to bring back the fucking hologram of him being critical of us.
Yeah.
And there are lots of them. Tupac was in his songs and his interviews was super critical of us. He wasn't able to, I don't think, healthily reckon with his critique, but he was super critical. So if we want to bring back a fucking hologram, bring back a hologram of him telling us the truth to our face. Not fucking bringing back these holograms of him, like, you know, doing shit with Snoop and doing, like, I think some of the music that wasn't so thoughtful.
Yeah.
Bring back him, the part of him that we ran away from when he was alive.
Well, here we actually hit the commercial capitalistic nexus, which is not going to allow any of the unpleasant feelings, especially in our +1 digital light culture.
Right.
I mean, you know, so I guess if we're to go ahead and create digital ghosts, maybe the outsider culture is going to have to create their own alternative ghost of Tupac, and they may very well be competing Tupac digital ghosts. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but then this is what I'm saying about earlier, but that about tickets, that Tupac's not going to sell tickets, man.
Yeah.
You know, like that, Tupac made a lot of music before he signed with Def Row.
Yeah.
And when he signed with Def Row, he started selling more tickets. And I think some of his music changed. And I think some of his music became a little bit more obsessed with death and destruction. And I think Machiavelli, his last album, we started to see him kind of make some moves. But it's just interesting that the things that often sell the most tickets are things that leave us feeling the most innocent and are the most spectacular, like, vacuous shit on earth.
Well, how do we get around this mass cultural trap? I mean, is there a way really to do it? I mean, Twitter and social media, I mean, this allows us something.
Well, we're doing it. Well, on one hand, that's what I want to say.
Yeah.
Like, the thing about social media is that we're doing it, man. Like, there are young activists, artists, creators out there that are just killing it.
Yeah.
And, they're doing it. They're doing it on radio. They're doing it in paintings. They're doing it with essay writing. They're doing it. And there's an audience for it. Now, will these people ever get mass audiences? I don't know. But I don't know that they need mass audiences.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, you know.
But then, of course, there's the ignoble label Black Twitter as well, you know.
Well, yeah. Like,
I mean, I kind of joke in the house, hey, look what White Twitter's talking about. You know?
Well, but that's the thing.
I mean,
like, White Twitter is so, what would White Twitter be when there's so many, there's just so many white people? Like, what is... You know, and that's the thing about black, like, we don't, they're not a lot of us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, one of the reasons there's Black Twitter is because one of the reasons Black Twitter is because of, like, the style and the content and the history of what people are writing through and about in Black Twitter. And Black Twitter, I think, has done a lot of wonderful shit. But, like, what, White Twitter is Twitter. You know what I'm saying? Like, White Twitter is Twitter. And that's why you can call something Black Twitter, because White Twitter is Twitter.
Well, okay, let me give you an example. I was curious to get your thoughts on this because I hadn't seen them anywhere, but Solidarity for White Women, that whole hashtag was fascinating to me because it really sort of exposed this divide, because with the Harriet Tubman sex tape, you didn't see any of the sort of hardcore sites on the white feminist side. Jezebel, they didn't say anything really about it.
Yeah.
In fact, I got into it with a couple people and lost followers over this question. It's like, why aren't these people talking about something?
Yeah.
Here's a perfect opportunity to unite so many fronts.
Right.
And yet, you know, no, well, we don't really talk about this. And it was driving, you know, driving a lot of people I know crazy. So,
but you know what I think about that, man? Like, I think it would have said a lot about us as a nation and those particular, you know, quote unquote white feminists, if they would have gotten involved in that conversation. But what I do know is that black feminists of all different races and genders were super involved in it.
Oh yeah.
And pushing people to think differently.
I love that hashtag. It was hilarious.
Things,
yeah.
That's one of those things where I can just be like, I don't know why white folks didn't get involved, but I know there was some super important work being done without white people getting involved. So it would have been great if they got involved.
Look, there was super important work, but the issue, again, comes back to the worst of white folks, I think, in this case, because they don't want to share the platform. They don't want to share the megaphone.
Right.
And that is why this hashtag cropped up and why it's still being discussed.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, nothing to say, but that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
Well, what do you think it's going to take? I mean, do you have any ideas? Or is it something that really doesn't concern you? Or should?
I mean, it definitely concerns me, man. I wish I could say it didn't concern me. Yeah. I wish I could say, like, you know, what white folks do and write and whatever, like, doesn't really concern me. But the fallout is, and the collateral damage from the lack of inaction is too deep for somebody to say, like, it doesn't concern. But what I'm saying, it doesn't concern me in that scenario, because great work was being done by other, you know, by really, like, black women. Like, black women, particularly black women who consider themselves feminists, like, just did, like, incredible amounts of work on Twitter. Like, pushing themselves, pushing other people. And so that's what I'm saying in that situation. I don't really care what those white feminists were saying in that situation. But I think that might be lazy on my part.
Ah, so we're all guilty of not engaging in all culture, I guess.
I guess so.
Yeah.
We all have our
sort of blind spots.
I learned a lot from that. Yeah. And I learned a lot from a lot of the like black women and black feminists that I know, black women feminists that I know. And so I can't be, you know, I can't be like, well, fuck, I wish I would have learned it from some white women. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I, that's not what I feel. And you know, and there was groups of men that pushed back, too. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this reminds me of one moment in Long Division where they're discussing the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And the issue is, why are white people going after white people? And this supersedes all considerations of this terrible,
of course,
unspeakable thing. And it got me sort of thinking, well, man, you know, I mean, could you apply this to slavery? Could you apply this to any other issue that really, when you bring race into anything, you know, it kind of changes the focus so that there isn't a real discussion, although this side discussion is also just as real in its own way.
I actually think that discussion that those kids have is a real discussion,
yeah,
right? And it's not real but just because other people might actually feel it. Like, I mean, they were honestly asking questions, right? Like,
yeah.
Shalaya Crump and City could not understand and really disbelieved. And it has something to do with education, I guess, but they just could not understand, like, how white people would kill millions of white people. And it has everything to do with, like, where they live,
yeah,
what their parents have said, what their parents have experienced, what their grandparents have experienced. And so, to me, like, one of the most important scenes in that book is when, one of the most important scenes is when, you know, they're talking to Evan, and then they're like, Evan, don't you get, like, they would never come for black us to get white you. They would never do it. But then Evan's like, okay, but what if they did? And, you know, and that's a terrible, I mean, that's a question. Like, that is a question. Like, if they came to black Southerners to get Jewish Southerners, and it meant possibly that black Southerners could survive unterrorized, would black Southerners terrorize black Jewish people? I don't like the answer to that question, but I think I know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And so, you know what I mean? But the reality is it hasn't happened here, and it won't happen here. But more importantly, like, we aren't immune. Like, black community, we can do some fucked up shit.
Yeah.
And we can make deals with white people on fucked up terms just like everybody else. But we don't often get the opportunity to.
Yeah. But if it's not the Holocaust, if it's not slavery, it's income inequality. It's like people hoarding the wealth and forcing people into just abysmal work situations where they're doing nothing but that and they're working three or four jobs.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's always going to be something. And I guess we're kind of talking in circles here, but it goes back to that issue of cultural awareness. And
yeah.
And that's a good place to stop.
Okay.
But
I mean, it's
yeah,
heavy, man.
Yeah, yeah. Some interesting.
It's
anyway,
a heavy conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. But Keezy, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. Thank you. I'll paint all the world for you, baby.
Yeah. I wish you saw the bigger picture. If I make it, I come back to get you. It's clear as day, but you don't see the vision. I wish you saw the bigger picture. What we got deserves some patience, cause this ain't no finger pain. I wish you saw the bigger picture. Beautiful and modern all the same. But what's a photo if it's out of frame? I wish you saw the bigger picture. I pray you see the